Muzika vibranti tal-grupp eccellenti Ingliż Killing Joke jien Albert Bell nistlinkom għal-programm ieħor mis-sensiela Connect. Sensiela li kif tafu hija mkellam il-fakultà tisjih tas-soċjetà fejn kull ġimgħa flimkien mal-mistednin tiegħi niddiskutu diversi aspetti relatati mal-fakultà u mad-dipartimenti li jagħmlu parti minn din il-fakultà b'enfasi speċjali fuq il-programm ta' riċerka u programmi ta' studji li jkunu għaddejjin f'dawn id-dipartimenti varji. Illum għal dan il-għan huwa pjaċir kbir tiegħi li nilqa' magħna lill-Dr. Maria Pizzani li hija lecturer fil- Departiment tal-Istudji taż-żgħażagħ u l-Komunità. Merħba Marija.
Ejja.
Marija għalkemm Maltija pura u siġġewija pura jkolli ngħidu x'hekk.
Eżatt.
Għamlet ħafna snin tgħix barra u speċjalment l-Ingilterra u tħoss iktar komda li niddiskutu ftit bl-Ingliż u għal dan il-għan tal-programm illum sammexxuh b'dan-mod. So Marija, welcome, thank you for accepting our invitation.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're the first guest that I've had from the Department of Youth and Community Studies, so I think it's opportune that we start off, if you can, by giving us some information on the department's rationale, its vision, some history, some important milestones, and perhaps also some insights on the department's program of studies.
Department of Youth and Community Studies, I always smile because I feel a real sense of pride when I say I'm a part of the department. I was actually, the course has been running, I think, for 24 years.
Since 1993.
We're in our 24th academic year, probably. I think I was part of the second or third cohort, something like that. So I was a student myself. I came to university as a mature student, did the degree and did the diploma. And I've always said, if I'm going to be completely honest, I did the course because it was offered in the evening and it was the only course I could do, but literally fell in love with the course immediately, and from that point onwards never looked back, really. So it's something that's very, very dear to my heart, the whole rationale behind the course. Well, the focus is on young people in their entirety. The world has changed very much since I did the course myself, so obviously the content has changed as well, but the main focus,
the thrust
is the focus, the thrust is young people within society, the different elements of young people, their individual lives. So obviously it necessarily is multidisciplinary, looking from psychology to sociology of youth. Nowadays we've moved into social media and young people and subcultures, young people and crime, young people and leisure and sports and so on. So very vast. And then young people in the world as well, in this globalized world. So I think a fascinating subject. And if you're looking at society from any angle, you cannot but look at young people, whether it's looking at health, employment, social media, globalization. Young people come, they're at the core. They're at the core.
The course also, we're talking about the bachelor's degree here, also has an emphasis on youth work skills. So what's the story about that?
So the course prepares the students for working as youth workers. It leads actually to a profession as youth workers. There are many different definitions, if you like, and understandings of what a youth worker is. My take is, broadly speaking, is as a professional working with and alongside young people, with a strong element of informal and non-formal education. And then there are many different takes. I tend to be a little bit more radical in my own approach, take a very critical approach to this educational process. Mm-hmm. I personally feel that the notion of critical education is becoming more and more important. We prepare young, we work with young people to question everything that's going on in society. And I think the course and youth work has an important role to play in this regard.
There's been some important developments in the field in respect of youth work services. Can you tell us something about that and what the prospects hold for prospective applicants for a youth studies degree?
Well, the National Youth Agency and Agencia Zarzach are doing an incredible amount of work and offering a number of different services for young people. And then, of course, there are different services under different agencies as well. So you will find youth teams with APOCH, youth teams with ETC, and so on and so forth. Agencia Zarzach, relatively speaking, is a new agency, and I would say not just a flagship for Malta, but for youth work in general, actually. The Miriam, who was also a former student and one of our lecturers, has done a phenomenal amount of work developing the program, should I say, and the services that are provided for young people. Different services, many different services, responding to the multifaceted needs of young people in Maltese society.
As a nation, we've also made a huge headway in terms of the professionalization of youth work. What reflections do you have about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting for me. You know, I feel quite privileged to be able to travel and speak about youth work in Malta, especially in other EU member states. And there's always a lot of interest, given the fact that Malta has really progressed in this regard. Youth work is recognized as a profession in Malta. It's an important step in the right direction. The course prepares our students very well for working with young people, and again, in a number of different ways. And the needs of young people are constantly responding, and youth workers are ready and prepared to respond to these new needs and these new challenges.
Okay, so let's start focusing a bit on your own personal academic trajectory. As you said, the department can consider you as one of our most important flag bearers or most prominent flag bearers. But I know that you also tend to describe yourself, especially given what is also elaborated in your bio notes, as an academic activist or an activist researcher. How do you think that does this dual role impinge on your research work?
It's funny because, again, it's a question. The first time I was asked this question, I was a little bit shocked by it. And it has garnered quite a lot of interest. For me, perhaps it was something that I needed to reflect on before I actually came out and said it. But it was something so natural that it's so much a part of me that I didn't actually reflect on it until people started asking me questions about it. My research is critical, my academic work is unapologetically political. I always start from that premise. Once I have, I think for me the easy, and this does not remove
so
from
no,
this objectivity.
I'm
out there.
Of
no, I'm not pretending. I am embracing my bias that I believe everybody has, and I just put it out there in advance and say, this is my bias, this is where I am at, and I make no, I don't pretend otherwise, but I believe everybody has a bias. And once I've conducted that research, and once the findings are what they are, I just take it a step further and use them. I think that is the only difference between me and somebody who just stops by publishing, really. I make a point of using that work to feed into what I would consider to be praxis, my praxis then, feeding into my practice at a political level and also in terms of service provision as well, and definitely policy development.
Let's have a more closer look at your background as an activist. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I'm not really sure when that started. I think the political engagement was at a very young age. But I had been working whilst I was studying during my degree and then my master's. I was actually working with SETA for 6 years as a drugs worker. And then that moved under APOCH, and at the time the refugees started arriving in Malta, the boats started arriving in Malta, and APOCH set up a department within the agency, and I requested a transfer.
So your background as an activist within the refugee field preceded your academic interest there?
I would say everything Aaron, my interest in, I was already studying, but I had not looked at refugee issues. It was youth work, and always with a focus on marginalized populations. So, for example, in my degree, I focused on substance abuse, for example.
That's your BA degree?
My BA degree. And then I requested a transfer to work with refugees. That coincided with my master's. Again, in youth work, and I was running the first open center in Malta. And whilst I was doing the master's, my dissertation focused on young forced migrants. Mm-hmm. When I was working with the with the government running the first open center, I became very aware of the situation politically. I wasn't allowed to speak. And I had to choose between continuing in that job or speaking publicly, and I could not speak. So I resigned and set up the NGO. Well, I set up the NGO Integra Foundation with my partner Sean and my dear friend Mario, and that was 12 years ago. Today, Integra, it's run completely on a voluntary basis. We're maybe 12, 13 volunteers. I'm the person that everybody sees and everybody hears.
Is it just about awareness raising?
But no, we provide services. That's what I'm saying. Everyone sort of hears and sees me, but there's a whole team behind me who are quietly just getting on and doing their own thing. So we provide English and Maltese lessons in Floriana on a weekly basis. That's well attended. We started with English, and then the refugees said we want to learn Maltese.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so and luckily people came forward and said, well, we'll teach English or we'll teach Maltese. So they just give up their time. We run a drop-in center in Valletta that's open three times a week. We have internet there, a library, and it's a safe space where we teach more sort of what I call emergency English, and maybe play games, have conversations, but we do this in English. And then obviously, a lot of my work is on advocacy as well, and in close collaboration with other NGOs working in Malta. We've conducted research. We do actually have another project, which is a development project in Guatemala, kind of completely separate, but it also falls under Integra, although this is also a collaboration with the Critical Institute. So no, we do a lot of different things, service provision and advocacy, and it's all thanks to a team of volunteers, Maltese and other migrants as well.
Interesting. Let's focus some more on your own research work. I know you've done some fantastic work on refugees and migrants. Can you tell us something more about that, and whether this whole dual role, this activist researcher role, also has some sort of impact on what sort of research strategies you use in your own work, or have used in your doctorate, for example?
Yeah, well, my doctorate kind of brought youth and community studies, or let's say critical pedagogy, which is a very important element, I think, of youth work, with migration together. So my PhD looked at non-formal educational provision for rejected female asylum seekers. So initially my focus was always on women, and specifically young women, non-formal education, and then I married that, if you like, with refugees. I always use qualitative approaches with a commitment to giving voice, and I always adopt a critical perspective.
Did they also have an action research approach? Or?
My PhD didn't. At the moment, I'm working with Warwick on a multi-site piece of research. It's an ethnography. But we have more recently, as Integra, conducted action research together with UNHCR. I would say this is the, I wouldn't call it pure action research, but there was a real commitment to engage refugees throughout the research process.
Can you elaborate a bit on for the benefits of our listeners, the strengths of action research?
The strengths and where things went wrong as well. Yeah. I mean, so I call it action research, but again, I'm bracketing this. At the end of the day, the funding was provided by UNHCR. The agenda was set by UNHCR. Mm-hmm. So let's not pretend that refugees came in and said, oh, let's do this. So already control is negotiated, if you like.
So it wasn't really a bottom-up
approach. It wasn't born from the refugees. UNHCR wanted to look at access to services from what they call an AGD perspective, an age, gender, and diversity perspective, which the refugees that engaged in the project agreed was an important subject. It's not like we was doing something that they weren't interested in. It may not have been their priority, however. So we worked with a team of refugee researchers who we selected. So again, we can look at the power issues there as well. But we tried to get a diverse team with different statuses, different genders, different age. We thought about disability. We thought about even gender, sexual orientation. So try and get a diverse research team together as possible. Together, we designed the questionnaires. The open-ended questions, trying to
the interview schedule,
trying to promote as much conversation and bottom-up approach as possible. The analysis was done together with the refugees as well, and then also with other stakeholders. So we went through a number of phases, and it included a pilot. The initial findings fed into three pilot projects that were identified by the findings. So we focused, interestingly, on young people and sports, providing. We organized a football tournament, the football being the means to the end rather than the end in its own right. So engaging very much in informal education there. Another project on disability and another project on LGBTIQ issues related to refugees. So these emerged from the findings. And then the projects, the pilot projects, were evaluated with the refugees that fed into the final report. So I would say strongly participatory, which, I mean, again, with many limitations, but certainly the direction that we'd like to take our academic work or our research in general.
Fantastic. I'm also sure that your, as you yourself said, that your research work has also lots of policy implications. Can you tell us something about that? And if you had to assess, for example, efforts at integration in Malta, how would you appraise that scenario? I know we need 45 minutes, won't it?
I mean, obviously, the findings of over the years, we had been very, very critical of the detention policy. And it's certainly not research on its own, but the collective efforts of international NGOs, different UN bodies, and researchers like myself, and NGOs, small NGOs like Integra, Aditus, JRS, and so on, have worked very, very hard and worked closely with the government as well at times. And the detention policy in Malta did undergo change as a result of that. We don't know how effective this change is because the boats have stopped arriving, but that has been effective. In terms of our advocacy, we've also been very successful and not successful. Integration, well, we still don't have an integration policy. Refugees are integrating, but I would say that's a bottom-up effort rather than a...
what do you think is stimulating the integration?
Human beings stimulate integration. People, you know, this black man suddenly becomes Mohammed once he's living next door to you, or that you might sit together on a bus or be working together. It's the interaction, human beings interacting. Sometimes there's fear at the beginning, initially, not sometimes, generally there's fear, but over the years, we're talking about 12 years now, that, I mean, the first boats actually came in the late 90s, but 2002, so what am I saying, 12 years, 14 years, well, you know, there are refugees and even rejected asylum seekers that have been living in Malta for 10, 11, 12, 14 years, working, some of them even employing Maltese people, married to Maltese, they have children here, their children have grown up here, they speak much better Maltese than I will ever hope to speak. They are Maltese in every sense of the word, but citizenship, really.
But if you had to look at what's happening critically, more critically, in the field, so what would you assess to be the avenues, the future pathways for development and of policy in the sector? Because we're seeing, for example,
You're asking me in a week where, you know, I mean, where I'm very disappointed. Very disappointed with the way things are going. Certain policy approaches are worrying for me in Malta. And then let's talk about the last 2 weeks globally where there really isn't much to celebrate. I've just come out of a fascinating talk this morning by a Syrian cartoonist. We have a war that's been going on for 5 years. That's just one war. We have more refugees displaced globally than we've ever had since the Second World War. we are now living in a world of that has been defined as post-truth politics. We have Brexit, we have Trump, we have walls going up, fences being razor-wired, fences being built where, you know, just a, you know, 2 decades ago we were celebrating them coming down. So I think these are ugly times and they're challenging times. And sometimes I just want to hide myself in a room and hug my unicorn. I do actually have a unicorn. they're challenging times. But at the same time, I think a lot of positive things happening as well. People are asking questions. People are asking the right questions. People are, we see the violation of rights, but we also see people standing up for rights. There's so much going on that it's difficult for me to pinpoint something and say, you know, let me focus on where I'm at with my, because it's so diverse, so complex that it's impossible to say, well, we need to look at this and we need to look at that. But broadly speaking, this is a globalization and the nation state. This is a toxic space, and the refugee, the migrant, the non-citizen, the dark non-citizen in particular embodies this toxic space.
Would you also see the rise of the new radical right as a consequence of this toxic space?
Well, when I speak about the nation state, the nation state and national identity is directly linked to the rise of the far right. When we listen to far right discourse, it's very much focused on what it means to be Maltese, for example.
Yeah, but the nation state can be as much an artificial construct as globalization itself.
Absolutely. At the end of the day, we're talking about social constructions here with real effects, though. So if we're looking at a discourse that is focused on what it means to be Maltese, on protecting a border, protecting the nation and the Maltese citizen, that is assumed to be pure and indigenous from this dark, exotic, dangerous other, that is a toxic space. And this discourse is feeding into policies that not only violate rights on paper, but also cause great harm.
Don't you think that the type of politics that seems to come into play today, which is very appeasing and very pragmatic, and mostly interested on vote capture, tends to give rise to these extreme positions?
I don't even think it's pragmatic politics. It's populist politics. The practical solution, the practical way to go, the pragmatic solution is not necessarily the way governments are going. And I'm certainly not just looking at the Maltese state. I'm looking at governments
pragmatic
across the board.
Pragmatic in the sense of vote capture.
Vote capture. It is all about votes. And at the end of the day, the refugee does not have the vote. So yes, of course. And this is where my focus has been from an academic perspective. I call it the citizenship assumption. At the end of the day, we can look, my argument has been, and I'm certainly not from a social science perspective, in simplistic terms, I have argued that whilst we have focused on age in terms of youth work, race, ethnicity, gender, disability, and so on, access to rights, we have assumed citizenship, that every person has the right to rights. That is what I called the citizenship assumption. And what I'm saying isn't actually new. This is the right to rights was questioned by Hannah Arendt, amongst others, post-Second World War. Today we are living in a world, we can see it, it's literally under our noses today, that those rights, if they can be guaranteed at all, are guaranteed for the citizen. And the citizen is the exclusionary category, if you like. And our politics, liberal democracy, power is decided by the citizen.
In fact, I was going to ask, because what you've just said now, very interesting insights, but it set me think that can we really describe, I mean, we often say that Malta today is shifting towards this neoliberal, progressive society. Can you really appraise Malta in that way?
There are certainly elements, but if we're looking at globalization, you can't speak about globalization without speaking about globalization. Neoliberalism may, for example, push for open borders when it comes to capital, when it comes to, but then against this, and even for the free movement of, and even for labour crossing borders. But neoliberalism also depends on cheap labour. So yes, it's all part and parcel, but it's not just about neoliberalism, it's also about the nation state and politics. So again, for me, it's that toxic space between globalisation and nation state as well. It's all part, if you like, of that same mix, which is incredibly complex and I'm finding difficult to unpack, given our really limited time.
Yeah. And with those very insightful and provocative thoughts and observations from Maria, we come to an end of another program of Connect. ħanaqlef tid-bil-Malti.
Iwa, kompli.
Kultant biex taqleb bejn il-lingwi, mhux faċli. U dawk il-kummenti konklusivi naslu fit-tmiem ta' programm ieħor Connect, nistlinkom terġgħu tingħaqdu magħna nhar terba fl-10 fejn ikollna mistieden ieħor u nerġgħu nittrattaw temi oħrajn relatati mal-fakultà tis-sieħ tas-soċjetà. Tislijiet.